Let me first thank you for originally inviting me and then for organizing this alternative way. So I'm going to talk about bulk observables in JT gravity, and my talk will be roughly based on these three papers. So the first two appeared last year, and the last one will hopefully appear next week. So first, a brief outline of my talk. So I'm going to start by motivating why studying JT gravity is interesting. And I will also describe how to get some solutions, quantum solutions of this theory. And then I will go on with the main part of my talk, which will be about bulk correlation functions. So we will go into the holographic bulk. And in particular, I will talk about the bulk two-point function and some of the physical effects that this, some of the physical lessons we can learn from this. And then the second part of my talk will be about basically Fourier transforming this to go to the Unruh heat bath. And I will talk about an Unruh with linear detector and also the bath spectral energy density. Okay, so let me first briefly introduce the model. So Chakiv-Teitelbaum gravity, or JT gravity, is a specific model of 2D dilaton gravity. So I've written down the action here. So it consists of the Ricci scalar here being directly coupled to the dilaton field phi. I've added this plus 2 here, which means that I'm studying this thing on an ADS background. So there's a negative cosmological constant here. And I also have a boundary term if I study this on a manifold with a boundary, which is, of course, the thing that I will want to do in holography. The K is the extrinsic curvature trace, and phi boundary is the boundary value of the dilaton. Now, first, some motivation on why studying this specific model of gravity is interesting. So a first reason is that this model is just the spherically symmetric dimensional reduction of 3D pure gravity. Secondly, it also appears quite generically as the near horizon theory of near extremal higher dimensional black holes. And then the reason why it appeared in the last few years, in 2015 basically, by Kitaev when he introduced these SYK-like models, because the low energy sector of all known SYK-like models is actually being described holographically by a gravitational theory that looks like JT gravity. The full SYK model, its dual contains more than that, but at low energies, there's a pure gravity sector, and that one is described by JT gravity. And then a fourth reason is that this model is actually exactly solvable, including coupling to matter fields, or at least partially, and I will describe some aspects of this. So the main part of my talk will be to discuss bulk quantum gravity physics we can learn from this specific model. So let's now imagine actually trying to solve this. So we insert this action in a path integral. And because the dilaton field appears linearly in here, we can just path integrate over the dilaton field, which is just giving you, which is just a Lagrange multiplier, and is just giving you a delta functional constraint that the Ricci scalar is everywhere constant. And by my choice of units, just equal to -2 here. So I have a negatively curved space. And because I'm doing this in two dimensions, the geometry is actually fully fixed as some patch of the ADS2 geometry. So what I've written down here is the Poincaré metric of the ADS2 geometry. And well, the actual geometry will be some subset of this or some extension maybe. So the Z coordinate is the radial holographic coordinate, and Z0 will be the holographic boundary. I have denoted the Poincaré time coordinate by a big F here. So that notation will become apparent later on. So big F and big Z are the Poincaré the radial and the time coordinates. Is there a question?
Yes. Can the dilaton field be interpreted as a degree of freedom of a higher dimensional gravity? So this is a dimensional reduction.
Yes, precisely. That was my first comment. So if you do the spherically symmetric sector of 3D gravity, the let's say G55 metric component, the one that's in front of the third coordinate, that one will just be the dilaton field if you do a dimensional reduction.
All right, thank you.
So you can really view this as coming from higher dimensions.
And is this roughly the same thing as the Gaudi model?
Sorry?
The Gaudi model is a reduction from 3 plus 1 to 1 plus 1, where you have one of the two polarizations that's remaining fixed.
I'm not familiar with that model, so I don't know. Yeah, I can't say anything, sorry.
Okay, it would be interesting to know that, because a lot is known about that model.
Okay, thanks for the comment. Okay, so now that we know that the geometry is fixed as some slice of ADS2, it is convenient to quickly review the important classical frames in ADS2. So introducing light cone coordinates in the Poincaré frame. So big U and big V are the two light cone coordinates associated to F and Z, the Poincaré coordinates. Then, well, there are several major classical frames here. The first one we have just discussed, the Poincaré patch itself. And that one is found in, from a higher dimensional perspective, in the near horizon regime of an extremal black hole. And when I write it in terms of these light cone coordinates, it's obvious that there is an isometry here. It's very explicit, which is just the SL2R group, which acts on these light cone coordinates by these Möbius transforms. But there is a second important frame or patch in this geometry, which is something that I will call the black hole frame, where we take this big U and big V and we do a chiral transformation on both of them, and we replace them by a hyperbolic tangent of pi over beta times small u and small v. So I have defined new coordinates, small u and small v, that are related to the Poincaré coordinates in this specific way, just plugging them in the Poincaré patch, and this is the geometry you would get. And this is the kind of geometry you immediately obtain when you look at the near horizon regime of a near extremal black hole. And this thing actually, well, it is a black hole geometry in two dimensions. And if you, well, compute things with it, you can actually see that the temperature is just 1/beta. So the notation was well, obvious from the beginning, and is proportional to the square root of what turns out to be the mass of the black hole. So this is a two-dimensional black hole, much like the Rindler frame compared to the Minkowski frame. So there's just horizons. There's no coordinate singularity or anything like that because we're in two dimensions. And just to summarize, basically, I've drawn here the Penrose diagrams of these different frames. So I haven't discussed the global frame, but it's this, well, white strip, let's say. And you can draw the Penrose diagram of the Poincaré frame as this big triangle. And then the black hole frame, related by this hyperbolic tangent transformation, is this smaller green triangle. So these are the Penrose diagrams of these frames. So now let's continue with our quantum mechanical approach. So we have path integrated out the dilaton field to see that we actually have a patch of ADS2. But then at the level of the action, we are only left with the boundary term. So the Gibbons-Hawking boundary-like term is the only one that remains. So now we need to impose suitable boundary conditions to get an interesting theory. And we will consider the boundary curve. Well, we will parameterize it by f of tau and z of tau. So f and z were the Poincaré coordinates, and tau is some proper time coordinate. And we will use this wiggly boundary curve as a UV cutoff. So this carves out a shape from the ADS2 geometry close to the boundary. And how will we determine this particular form? Well, we will impose two conditions. The first is that the geometry is asymptotically Poincaré. So this is just the usual thing where in ADS CFT, you impose the Pfefferman-Graham gauge basically. And then you deduce this relation between the two coordinates that describe this wiggly boundary curve. So in the end, this boundary curve is described by just one function, f of tau, which you can view as a time reparametrization from a proper time coordinate tau to the Poincaré time coordinate big F. So this is the standard thing to do in ADS-CFT. But in this particular case, there is a second boundary condition that we will impose, which is not ordinarily done in higher dimensions, but here it happens because this dilaton is acting funny because it blows up close to the boundary. So we will impose that the boundary value of this dilaton will be constant. So along this wiggly boundary curve, the dilaton value will take a constant and large value that I parameterize in this specific way. So A over 2 epsilon, where epsilon goes to 0, and A is a dimension full parameter that describes the particular theory that I want to study. So this is labeling my theory.
Can I ask a question here? It's
Yeah,
since so much depends on the boundary condition, could you, and especially since there's a lot of people here just studying, you know, the effect of different edge modes and boundary conditions, could you comment a little bit more on the arbitrariness here? Here you're picking one because it's the usage and that's the most popular, but, find out another one. What's the, like, is there a fundamental principle, let's say, like, you know, or is just that, I mean, to be able to justify it from a deeper principle.
Yeah, so the first line is just the standard line. So your question, I guess, is about the second line, right? So how to choose this? Well, one way to...
Maybe even the first one. We know that sometimes when you fix a gauge at infinity, you're killing certain degrees of freedom. So there's always...
Yes, that's true. So this,
this is just an implementation. It's not really a physical, right? The question is, this is there a physical reason behind it?
Yeah, so this is just a standard Pfefferman-Graham gauge and that you use in ADS-CFT, and the residual diffeomorphism degrees of freedom that satisfy this, they will form the conformal group of the boundary. So the first boundary condition is the standard way to do holography. You might try to generalize this, but that's not what we have in mind here. The second boundary condition, that one is very peculiar, and that one is very particular to this model, and you can try to generalize this to find on other models. For instance, instead of a constant value of this number A, you can pick, for instance, a tau-dependent number here. But the resulting theory, you would get this, well, virtually the same. There's just one transformation you need to do to find out that they are the same. You do need to do something with the dilaton field, because if you solve the classical equations of motion of this system, which I haven't done here, you will find that the dilaton field is blowing up at the boundary, and ordinary matter fields that you put in an ADS-CFT context, they wouldn't do this. And the reason that this dilaton field is blowing up is, again, nicely illustrated if you go back to higher dimensions, because this dilaton field is secretly just a metric component of a higher dimensional ADS-CFT system. So that's one way of appreciating this. I don't know if I answered your question.
Maybe it will become clear later. That isn't some of the. And by the Pfefferman-Graham gauge, you mean the one where the radial lapse is equal is put to one?
I just have in mind that if you expand the geometry close to the horizon, you start out with first the Poincaré geometry and then plus subleading terms. That's what I have in mind here.
So you're fixing the boundary the induced metric to be flat?
Sorry, which metric?
The induced metric to be flat? Usually the induced metric is not flat. Usually the Pfefferman-Graham gauge is due to the fact that the radial coordinate, you fix the lapse.
Yes.
Like the radial lapse to be one, but that lapse could become a degrees of freedom, in fact.
Yeah. I just mean let's see. Just this geometry plus subleading terms as you go into the bulk. So this, as z goes to zero, this should be the leading contribution.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. And for instance, this geometry satisfies this property. This is just, I guess, the standard ADS-CFT boundary conditions people use. Also in particular, because the residual degrees of freedom precisely become the conformal group. So this is a very nice gauge to choose when you do holography. But maybe if it doesn't become clear, we can talk later, or you can ask the question later.
Okay, thanks.
So now that we have imposed these boundary conditions, we can actually just compute this boundary term. We can just plug in everything because we know the geometry is ADS2. We know that there's a wiggly boundary curve described by a single function f of tau. So we can just compute this pullback metric and the extrinsic curvature trace directly in terms of this unknown function, big F, this unknown reparametrization, and then just plugging everything in and, well, canceling this one term, which is just by holographic renormalization, you find out that your dynamics is governed by an action that looks like this, which is for which the Lagrangian is a Schwarzian derivative. So these brackets here just mean this higher derivative term. So that's the action of my system. And if you track the coefficients, there's a coupling constant big C, which is proportional to 1/2 Newton's constant that we had in our system, and then proportional to this arbitrary length scale small a that I introduced in my boundary condition. So this big C has dimensions of length. And the dynamics is fully described in terms of this time reparametrization. And you should compare this type of equality of going from the bulk to the boundary here, or to this boundary dynamics, to the way Chern-Simons and Wessel-Minowitten theory are related. So the large gauge transformations from Chern-Simons, they become physical and they describe they become the degrees of freedom described by the Wessel-Minowitten theory. And it's the same thing here. So these are large diffeomorphisms, time reparametrizations of the boundary, and they are physical now. They are no longer, diffeomorphism or gauge degrees of freedom. So as I mentioned, the big C has dimensions of length, which means from a power counting renormalizability perspective, this is a super renormalizable coupling. So this means that we expect that the quantum effects, quantum gravity effects described by this action, should become important in the infrared. which is of course unlike in higher dimensions, or at least in four and higher dimensions. Also notice that this big C is inversely proportional to Newton's constant in two dimensions. So if I want to study something like a semi-classical regime where Newton's constant or Planck's constant go to zero, I'm effectively studying large values of C. So that's where I should try to find semi-classics if that's what we're interested in. Okay, so, okay, now we have realized, or we know now, that JT gravity just reduces to an integral over the boundary frames with the Schwarzian action. So now we can try to compute general boundary correlators of the JT theory, of the Jacquive-Teitelbaum gravity theory, using this Schwarzian derivative action. So using this boundary action perspective. And by boundary correlators, I mean we insert operators purely within this Schwarzian system, within the Schwarzian action. So these are the types of correlators that I might be interested in. So I have a path integral over F, so over this boundary frame. My action is the Schwarzian derivative action that I just described. And I have immediately written this for the thermal theory. So the thermal theory is defined in this particular way. So the big F, I write this as another reparametrized version of a small f by using this tangent transformation. So this transformation is just the Euclidean version of the relation between the Poincaré frame and that black hole frame that I introduced in the beginning. So there we had a hyperbolic tangent, here it just becomes a normal tangent.
Sorry, could you comment, because you went from a quantum gravity, which is a Lorentzian theory, to this auxiliary system. So what's the relationship between the two?
Because I want to compute correlation functions, I will compute them using a path integral approach and Euclidean signature, and then Wick rotate at the very end.
Yeah, so, but
I want to
we know, in fact, in gravity, that's the central question in general. I don't know, because here we have lots of quantum gravity specialists. Usually what we do is that we define the theory in the Lorentzian regime. And often this is not the same as as the Euclidean. So here there's a big gap that you're replacing the quantum gravity by another system, which is not necessarily related to quantum gravity.
I'm defining the computations that I'm going to do in Euclidean signature as a Euclidean gravity computation, and then in the end I will Wick rotate the answers for the correlation functions and see what the real time effects are. So I agree that I'm not starting in real time and ending in real time. I'm doing the computation in Euclidean signature.
Yeah, but in gravity, there is no notion of Wick rotation, like when the metric is dynamical.
Yeah, but
so you don't. I mean,
I'm doing it at a level of correlation functions at the very end. So my correlation functions will look like, something that is amenable to a Wick rotation. So
that's possible, but maybe. I mean, because we have experience that sometimes things like discrete spectra, they disappear under this rotation. There's a certain operator that disappears.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
You see only part of the space-time. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of issues.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I agree, and I definitely think this is a delicate issue here. But most of the effects that I will study are defined Euclideanly, so we have to do something. So we Wick rotate our correlation functions at the very end and then see whether they reproduce things we would expect. At least in the, for instance, that the semi-classical regime works out and so on. And we have other checks for several quantities as well. But I agree, this is definitely a subtle point. At the level of the final answers for the correlation functions, I think it's probably, it's better, I think, to do it than generically.
Well, I don't know. I mean, let's say if you have spectra quantized, one thing we witness a lot in quantum gravity is that the area spectra become discrete and that you can't see in a Wick rotated version. There's no way.
Because,
so all this compactification of phase space or all these non-perturbative truly quantum gravity effects are kind of hidden.
I am going to do a lot of non-perturbative effects from the Euclidean perspective and then... try to interpret them in real time, but
end a map with Hilbert space, and you can, I mean, if you can relate this calculation to some kind of Hilbert space computation, then yes.
Maybe you should ask your question again when we do the concrete computations, and maybe thanks for the comment. So like I said, I'm going to do the computation in Euclidean signature, and I'm going to do it immediately for the thermal theory. So I have replaced this big F with this transformation to a small F, and I'm effectively path integrating over this small F now. And this small F, it is restricted to be a reparametrization of a circle. So this will be the thermal circle in Euclidean signature. So my integration manifold here is diff S1 mod SL2R. So the diff S1 means that this small F is reparametrizing a circle. So it satisfies these two conditions. The first condition says that if you go once around the circle in proper time, you should go once around it in this F time coordinate. And then F dot should always be non-negative to have a valid time reparametrization. So this is what the diff S1 means. We mod out by SL2R, and SL2R here is realized again in this Möbius way. And you can see that this actually comes from the isometry group of ADS2. So you can identify it with this. And we mod out by this because we view these configurations as equivalent. They just correspond to a rigid rotation of your entire ADS space. And we mod out by these. I'm not going to go in too deep into this. So you can find motivation more for this, both from the SYK perspective and from structural aspects of this theory in other papers, and if you want to learn more about this. Okay, so now that we have defined the integration space and the action, the measure is also well defined, but I haven't written it out here, but again, you can find it in literature. The question is, what are the natural operators to actually insert in this path integral? Well, it turns out that the natural class of operators are reparametrized boundary two-point functions. So let's motivate this. So suppose we take a massive scalar field in the ADS2 bulk. I've written it out, just schematically in terms of the coordinates, the Poincaré coordinates, big Z and big F. Then using standard methods from ADS CFT, you expand this very close to the holographic boundary and you write it in terms of, some power law with big Z, and then the boundary value of this field. Now, my boundary was this wiggly boundary curve where the big Z was actually equal to epsilon times F dot. So I just insert that. And I can also rewrite this boundary value in terms of another boundary field that I call phi B without the tilde, which is this time defined in this proper time coordinate. So this one only has an epsilon here. So the role of the Z coordinate for that proper time coordinate is played just by epsilon, not by big Z. Well, big Z is the Poincaré Z coordinate and it's related to epsilon by a multiplication with F dot. So these are all, the first relation is just inserting the boundary, and the second relation is defining for me what this boundary value in terms of proper time actually is. And now you can write down using standard ADS CFT methods, you can write down the generating functional for correlation functions of this theory. And it just looks like the first line. So this is just the textbook way of doing the generating functional for matter correlation functions. And this is defined in terms of the Poincaré coordinates, big F. Now I just use this formula that I've written at the top here to write this in terms of in terms of phi B, in terms of the proper times instead of Poincaré times. The only difference is that I pick up this F dot that appears here. And then these things, these objects that appear here, these would be my reparametrized boundary two-point functions. So this is an operator that depends on two times. So I've written it out here again. I have denoted big delta by L here because that's the notation I will use throughout, but of course it's the same. And this is a bilocal operator of the reparametrization degree of freedom. And this is the kind of operator that I'm going to insert in this Schwarzschild path integral. In the second line, I have rewritten it in terms of the small f. So remember that they are related just by a tangent transformation. And this is a bilocal operator. It depends on two times and it's parametrized by this number L. Okay, so this positive number L. So these are the natural operators to insert in your theory. So I have motivated this here from an ADS CFT perspective, but there are other ways to motivate why this is an interesting operator to consider. For instance, you can view this as a boundary anchored Wilson line when you write the gravity theory in its first order formulation as a gauge theory, which would be a BF theory. Then studying boundary anchored Wilson lines in that theory actually reduce to this kind of operator, of course, in a suitable representation of SL2R and so on. So for details, I refer to these papers. But for instance, a boundary anchored Wilson line has two endpoints. So you see why automatically, of course, it's a bilocal operator. So why? Well, it can work like that. So these are interesting, is an interesting class of operators to consider. Now, the problem still looks very hard because we are inserting these kinds of operators in an path integral with a higher derivative action. But it turns out you can actually solve them exactly. You can exactly do the integral with those operator insertions. And by now, several approaches to obtain these correlation functions exist. So I've listed a few here that have been developed throughout the years. So I'll not go into how you actually compute these things. I'll only mention that all of the results here agree. So we are quite confident that we know the answers to these correlation functions. And this is what they look like. So as an example, I've written out the correlation function for a single such bilocal operator. You can do it for more, but for the purposes of this talk, I will only need one of them. And this is the answer for this single bilocal correlation function after doing the Schwarzschild path integral. So you have two energy integrals, two dummy integrals, let's say, over E1 and E2. You have two density of state factors, rho zero of E2, rho zero of E1, where this rho zero is basically a singed square root E measure. Then you have two Hamiltonian propagation factors. So you have a Boltzmann factor here because I'm studying the thermal theory. And I have a Euclidean propagation factor here where tau 1, 2 is the difference between the two times, tau 1 minus tau 2. And then these two integrals, the E1 and E2 integral, they are coupled by this last factor, which is a bunch of gamma functions. By this plus minus notation, I mean you should take this the product of all of them. So this is actually a product of four gamma functions in the numerator. And this 1 over z appears here as well, and z is just a Schwarzschild disk partition function, so just a partition function. And this is the full answer for the correlation function of a single such operators for a single, boundary two-point function. Also notice that this E2 integral, it just appears as a Laplace transform up front. So if you want to go from the canonical to the microcanonical ensemble, it's very easy because you just strip off this Laplace E2 integral. And I will do that for the formulas later on. Okay, so this is for the boundary operators. So the goal of my talk is actually to talk about bulk operators and bulk observables. So now let's think about going into the bulk, into the JT bulk. Now in quantum gravity, defining a bulk observable, by which I mean a diff invariant operator, it requires care. For instance, if I give you a scalar field X in a curved space time, and I say this is phi of X, I should define what I mean by the symbol X here. I should actually define the bulk location in a geometrically invariant way. And because I'm doing holography, I should preferably do this in a boundary intrinsic way. So we will make a choice here on how to do this, on how to construct operators, and then we will actually do the computations with these operators. So I emphasize that this is a choice and other choices exist and they might lead to other results. So the choice I will make to define my bulk point or my bulk location is that given two times, small u and small v, on as proper time, so I define these on my boundary clock, I define a bulk point big U and big V, so the Poincaré light cone coordinates of that bulk point from the boundary reparametrization big F using the radar definition of a bulk point. So I define my bulk Poincaré coordinates as basically F of small u and F of small v, where small u and small v are the proper times and big U and big V are the bulk times. Is there a question or? Okay, sorry. So I have drawn this graphically here. So in blue and in red, I have drawn two samples, let's say, of this reparametrization, of this clock reparametrization. And at some fixed, two fixed marks or ticks on this clock, I send in a light ray and I extract the light ray, and where they intersect, that's where I define my bulk point. So this with the blue clock, I have chosen this bulk point, but with the red clock, I have actually landed here. So this point becomes fuzzy in the Poincaré geometry, but it is now anchored to my boundary clock. And that was my goal.
Sorry, I have a question, in fact, because here it's still a very classical discussion. So the central question in quantum gravity is about the commutator of physical
observation. Yeah, I will come to that.
So you're going to compute the commutator of U and V. Like, here you're talking as if guys were commuting, but they don't commute, right?
In the quantum theory. I'm defining everything as classical object, and I'm going to insert in a path integral. That's why perspective here.
At some point, yeah, okay. So you're not going to be able to compute the commit, because if you want to quantize,
I'm going to compute the commutator of operators, and they will implicitly have commutators of the metric in them. Not directly. I will compute commutators of operators that depend on this UNV. Okay. So it will be implicitly something like that, but not, you know, I will not do UNV separately. Because I'm not discussing the canonical quantization of canonical perspective on this problem. I'm only going to do the path integral perspective of these matter operators, basically.
Could I ask a quick question about the definition?
Yes.
Do you know if the point X is like a fixed phi value, or is like as in dilaton, or is it going to be have like different values of the dilaton?
Which point? The bulk point that I'm constructing?
Yeah, it's just like fixed.
Oh, it has nothing to do with the dilaton field at this moment.
Oh, okay. That's another way to get a diff invariant location. But
I definitely agree. And that's actually how this wiggly boundary curve is defined, because it follows a constant value of the dilaton field.
Okay, but these points are...
I'm choosing to define them using this clock. So I've showed that the bulk reduces to a reparametrization with the Schwarzian action. And I'm using this reparametrization to go back into the bulk and to define the bulk point.
Okay, but in general, it'll be different values of the dilaton depending on...
Okay, so with this definition of bulk points, our observables, for instance, some operator O in the bulk, which is at a location big U and big V, well, it will depend now on the reparametrization on the gravity variable big F implicitly because of this radar construction of defining the bulk point. Which means that you will get a contribution in the correlators from this implicit dependence. And this is visible, for instance, in commutator computations. For instance, in this paper by Donnelly and Giddings from a few years ago, they explicitly computed commutators like this. Well, not with this particular choice, but with other choices in higher dimensions and perturbatively. And they find contributions coming from the implicit dependence on the gravity variables. So we will have something like that here as well. Okay, so now to supply these actual bulk operators, we will couple JT gravity to a bulk matter action, and we will just take the massless scalar for simplicity. So my total action will just be the massless scalar in the ADS2 geometry plus the JT gravity action. And now using my definition of my bulk point and my bulk operators at this specific point, the matter two-point function in a fixed frame F will look like this. So this is just the bulk matter two-point function of a free boson in two dimensions, but now with the location of these bulk points specified by this reparametrization. So ordinarily, because the massless free boson is just a CFT system, of course, you would expect the two-point function just to be log of the distance between them. So here I have log of a cross ratio of distances, basically. And this is because I'm in ADS and I need to impose boundary conditions at the holographic boundary, and I chose Dirichlet boundary conditions here, which means there's an image charge contribution also here. So that's why this you have these multiple factors within this logarithm. But in essence, it's just a CFT two-point function. But you can see that it depends on F. So now, this is the matter two-point function. This is after doing the matter path integral, let's say. And now I'm going to insert this in the gravitational path integral, in the Schwarzian path integral over frames in a second step. So this object is going in the path integral over the Schwarzian. To reemphasize this process, and also the other things that I will mention in the next few slides, are always two-step processes where we first integrate over matter to get a gravitational operator, which we then insert in the gravitational path integral. So that's the strategy we will employ. So now I just want to compute this thing. I want to compute this integral over frames with this logarithmic two-point function inserted in it. So how do we do that? Well, there's a simple trick. You can just write this log as a double integral over this thing, which is just a Schwarzian bilocal, which is the correlation function that I showed you before. So we know what the answer is. We just need to integrate the answer that we had before. For the boundary two-point function, we need to integrate it twice. This trick actually just coincides with the HKLL prescription, so the bulk reconstruction formula, to map bulk operators into boundary operators. Within HKLL, you write the bulk operator as an integral with some kernel times a boundary operator. for the specific case of the two-dimensional massless boson, this kernel is just a Heaviside function, which is the only thing it does is restrict these two integrals. So this is really the HKLL formula. But now I view it just as a trick to actually be able to compute this gravity or the Schwarzschild path integral. So now it's technically easy. I just need to do that double integral, which I can do because it's just elementary functions. And this is the type of formula that I get. Okay, so now let's try to see what this formula is or what this formula is telling us. So what I've drawn here on the left is a Euclidean ADS2 diagram for the bulk two-point function. And I've put one of the operators at this black dot here. And then I put the other operator in some other location. So I've plotted here in different colors, different time separations of the two bulk operators, and then as a function of the radial coordinate of the second operator. So this dashed line here in the center, that's the radial location of the first operator, and then on the horizontal axis is the radial location of the second operator. Now these figures look like, well, they don't do super interesting things. The only thing that you can really see is that, well, you're going to develop a singularity as the two points, of course, coincide. And these are the only singularities. So you get singularities only at coincident points in Euclidean signature, which become light-like separated points if you do the Wick rotation to Lorentzian signature. And very close to these light cones where you get these divergences, you see that the behavior is logarithmic. So you get basically logarithmic divergences. The reason you get log divergences is because the operator itself at the top of this slide here was logarithmic. And as the operators go come very close together, you're probing the UV region. And as I mentioned in the beginning, this Schwarzschild theory is super renormalizable. So the UV region isn't changed. The IR region is changed. That's why you can just look at the classical operator here, which has logarithmic divergences to find the ones in the full correlation functions. The actual...
It's just a question. So you're saying... From what you're doing, there's no regularization due to quantum gravity. Usually in quantum gravity, there's a Planck lens that appear and we expect it to change the UV physics drastically.
Yeah, yeah.
And the role smooth out the singularities.
Yes. That's in higher dimensions. So as I mentioned in the beginning, the Schwarzschild theory, because of these boundary conditions that we actually imposed in JT gravity, it has a super renormalizable coupling, which means that just power counting estimations, you would predict that this theory would correct the IR and not the UV. So this doesn't cure, let's say, the CFT singularities you would have here. It doesn't smooth out these things. They're just the same. That's why this full theory is not truly a UV complete description. This is not like you would do in higher dimensions or you would want in higher dimensions.
But what about the naive picture that, now you have a fuzzy geometry, it fluctuates, and therefore the notion of points and light cone is not sharp. So therefore, singularities are smoothed out because points are kind of carrying an extra length. You were saying there's a length in the game, and that length affects the property of geometry itself. That's really...
Yes. But you only see the effects in IR in long distance and late time physics, not in short distance physics. That's a feature of this theory.
Is it because you're Euclidean, or is it
I don't think it's necessarily because we're doing things. Of course, every computation, as we talked before, is Euclidean. For instance, in this particular formula, I have just done the Wick rotation by replacing the minus tau by IT to get to the real-time correlators. So we do know a bit about the analytic structure of this object. So there are branch cuts in the complex tau plane and so on. So we have been careful about those to go to real-time. But so singularities are still, they're still the same basically as in the classical theory, as in the theory not coupled to gravity. And this will also be apparent in a couple of slides where I will talk about locality for these operators as well.
Because if you take the point of view of BF, which is the bulk quantization, then you can argue that time carries a discrete spectra. So then you can't really have a bulk, continuous time anymore.
I'm not sure. This looks like... I'm not sure how to match what you said with the concrete computations here. So It looks like a very different perspective on this. It would be interesting to to say more about. I think you're more asking about the canonical quantization.
Well, I mean, yeah, but you know, path integral and canonical are the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. So at some point, whatever you conclude from one,
yes.
Yeah, it's statement in the other.
I agree. It would
be fully quantized theory. So it's good to go to do both because it's opposite aspects. That's why. I'm more asking the one I can see from the.
So yeah, I can only do the path integral computations of these things. So it would be interesting to compare to a canonical perspective as well, and see how these features emerge from that perspective.
So from your perspective, the land scale that appear there's a land scale, so there's a deformation of the geometry.
Yeah. Yes.
Does not affect the UV physics.
And yes, precisely.
That's really hard to. But grasp for quantum gravity.
It's because it's low dimensions. Because Newton's constant in higher dimensions is irrelevant, but here
it
effectively becomes relevant. So that's because my boundary conditions, this Dilaton conditions, has effectively made for a super renormalizable coupling.
Yeah, but the Dilaton is an operator. I don't know. Yeah, the Dilaton is an operator, so it also fluctuates, right? So that's
yes. But
that's
I'm more thinking about the Schwarzschild perspective. So from that perspective, I understand things better than from the bulk perspective. But they should be equivalent by this argument that I gave at the very beginning. So all of the dynamics is actually mapped to this boundary fluctuating boundary dynamics.
Lee.
Okay.
Well, maybe let's discuss at the end. I mean, I have the same sentiment as Laurent, which I'll put less politely than Laurent is doing. I mean, if you don't have any, if you have a theory which has no issues in the ultraviolet and issues in the infrared, it's not a good model for the problems that we have to deal with in the real world.
Yeah. So
why is it interesting? You can invent lots of models this and models of that, but if it doesn't to start with have a strong coupling ultraviolet strong fluctuations problem, then it's not raising the problem that we're trying to solve. Am I being too harsh? I'm not trying to be unfriendly.
No. This theory is not a UV complete theory of gravity. For instance, if you look at things coming, or if you look at this thing as coming from a low energy limit of SYK, SYK is actually curing these singularities. SYK doesn't have these things, but it's only because we took a low energy approximation that we have them. So now, given this low energy approximation, my goal is to solve this thing, and it's actually relatively remarkable that people are able to do this completely analytically. And we can deduce important lessons for quantum gravity from this, but we can definitely not solve everything. I definitely do not claim that once we fully understand this, that we're done. Definitely not, because the UV problem should definitely be addressed. And
at the end, could you explain what important problems for quantum gravity were you got insight into or were resolved?
Yeah, well, that's my talk. That's the remainder of my talk, or at least to try to convince you.
Well, let's come back and discuss at the end.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah. Okay. So what I was saying is that this is just a plot of this bulk 2-point function, and these are some of the properties that I just mentioned. So only singularities at light-like separated points. Now, at a technical level, there are some generalizations you can do, and you can do them analytically. I won't go into the formulas. So you can generalize this from a massless scalar field to generic matter CFT primaries, for which you know the 2-point function. You just insert them in the Schwarzschild path integral, and you're done again. You can also generalize this type of computation to a massive bulk field, for which the 2-point function in ADS2 is just a 2F1 hypergeometric function. You reparametrize this thing, you insert it in the Schwarzschild pattern, and you can again do the computation. For this, you need to use another trick that I'm not writing here, but you can find them. You can find the trick in the papers. So the generic picture we get from these type of correlation functions, I've drawn it here. So imagine I insert one operator at this red dot here. Then what I've drawn here is, as I move the second operator around, where does it get contribute, or from what spectrum, from what part of the spectrum does it get contributions? So along the light rays and also the reflected light rays, so those are all the blue regions, you're close to the UV singularity, you get these logarithmic divergences that I mentioned before for the massless two-point function. And then the green parts are some intermediate regions, but then at very late times or very long separations, both in time and in space between these two operators, that's what I've drawn here in this red region, this is the IR region, and this is where this theory has strong gravitational fluctuations. So the gravitational fluctuations are infrared and not UV physics. So this is the picture we get in this case. So now let me try to describe some other physics, or some results that are easy to find now given these formulas. The first of these is a comment about bulk locality. So if we have local operators in a theory, they should commute for space-like separation. So because the commutator is just the difference of two orderings for the bulk two-point function, and we have the bulk two-point function, we can just compute this thing and check whether it's true. And it is satisfied. So for space-like separation, these operators that I have constructed in this way, in this radar definition way, they commute. So these operators are mutually local operators in the full quantum gravity and the bulk. Now, I would also want to refer to this paper from Maldacena and collaborator from last year, where they did another construction of diff invariant operators, and they also turn out to be local. So, the operators you naturally construct in this theory in JT gravity are actually more local than you would generically expect in quantum gravity. So again, I refer to this paper from Donnelly and Giddings, where they find even in perturbation theory that this locality statement is immediately violated generically. But for these operators, it isn't, and it's not even violated in the exact results. So these are not perturbative results in gravity, these are the exact results.
Can you say a bit more about how you even define the notion of space-like separated in a quantum gravity, fully quantum gravity theory?
Yes.
In fact, 2 points could be space-like, time-like, or null, depending on the value of the metric.
So yes, yes.
There's no fixed notion of what it means to be.
Yes. So I have introduced this proper time coordinate and also this proper Z coordinate in this radar construction, basically. And I just use those coordinates to define time-like, space-like, and light-like. So with that...
It means to me that you're assuming that these coordinates commute, which they would not in quantum gravity. So I think these are quantum gravity observables, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
I think... maybe that's why you don't get the UV regularization. Isn't there something circular in your argument? If you assume that you can label points by commuting coordinates, of course you're going to have a notion of locality, but the whole point of quantum gravity is to to show that you cannot, or to really understand to what extent.
Yeah, I definitely agree that generically this shouldn't happen. But this theory is low dimensional and is also peculiar. And I have also defined my operators in a very specific way. So
I don't know. I can think that, I can have generic argument that the metrics, which is the normal metric, like the TR metric, is non-commutative at the quantum gravity level. And then, and therefore, it doesn't matter what dimension I am in. Mm-hmm. But maybe, yeah. So I'm not sure if it's something you derive there or something. It's not clear to me that it's kind of a circular argument. If it's something you derive or something you put in by end, that T and Z or that the UV coordinates.
I don't think we put it in by hand though. We derive it in the sense that given these bulk 2-point functions, we can compute the commutator and check whether it's zero or not for space-like separation. But again, these might not be the operators or the kind of operators you would want to consider. They have a very specific construction.
Ultimately, there should be one. There should be a notion of a quantum gravity point. Mm-hmm. And then there should be only one operator. So the hard part of quantum gravity is to define exactly what you mean by a quantum gravity point. And usually, it's hard because your localization operator do not commute.
But there are many possible ways to define the bulk point, right? Or
you can do your way, like you refer, you take an observer
yes.
infinity and you refer, but it doesn't change the fact that this
that
the point get fuzzy, like the point themselves, like the coordinates mm-hmm. themselves here, because they become observable.
Yes, know, yes.
Maybe
yeah, so
here.
I don't think there's a mistake in the computations we did, but
No, I'm not saying it's maybe somewhere in the assumptions or.
I also don't know how to fully address your comment because I think your comment is coming more from a canonical perspective, and then it's hard in this.
But again, it should matter. Like you know that these questions are universal questions about quantum.
I agree.
Whatever is your model of quantum gravity,
yeah.
It should be, we should all agree at the end.
Yeah.
Whatever the route we take, we should all have...
So the big F, the Poincaré coordinates, they are the things that are operators and that don't commute, but these small coordinates, these small t and small z, those would be like the proper time coordinates and proper distance coordinates, and they would be just numbers. The embedding coordinates, let's say, they don't necessarily commute, but a priori, I mean.
Aldo has a question, or?
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. Hi. Maybe I'm off topic, but isn't the resolution of this problem the fact that you have only one metric effectively contributed to the path integral, which is the DS one. So you are defining your point relationally in it because you're saying, oh, I use these radar coordinates, so I fix my points on the boundaries and I can propagate them in. So I don't have to use coordinates to define the point. So I solve diff invariant in that way. However, the space-like relationship between these points, once you have defined them different invariantly, is fixed because there is just the ADS metric involved, which is just whatever it is. It's not that we're integrating also over metrics. Is that the
geometries are quite, they're not wild in this case because everything is just, it's a theory of frames and that's it. So, yeah.
Yeah, the metric is fixed all the time, no?
Well, the geometry, but then you can still change the patch of the ADS2 geometry. You can still choose different coordinates on that. And the boundary value of those coordinates, that is the physical thing. That is this time.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. So in a way, once you define your point inside, whether they're space-like separated or not is given. It's not something you're integrating over. Is that...
I think that's the usual mistake that some, you know, like if you fix it classically, you don't care about the Poisson bracket of observable, you can decide there's only one metric, but you know, what you have to do is to be very careful about that. You have to let all possible representation of that geometry. So the question of quantum gravity is whether it's about how many states there is in a given classical geometry, and in fact, you know, we have a lot of information that maybe there's many quantum gravity states in one classical geometry, and the goal of quantum gravity is to find out what are these microstates. So, mm-hmm. Of course, if you assume that one classical state is one classical geometry, one classical geometry is one quantum state, then you know you find this kind of local result. But the proper way to do is not to assume that and really see and count carefully and see that sometimes, in fact, you know, we know at quantum gravity level that there's many different realization of flat space, for instance, like flat space contains many quantum states, even if it's only one classical object. So, yeah, so I think it's related, yes, but in the sense that people have assumed there's only one quantum state associated to one classical state.
I have not a priori necessarily assumed that these operators are local. So I have constructed them using diffeomorphism invariance. That was the main constraint, and then I checked this commutator. That was a strategy. But this model, because the bulk geometry is only dynamics is in a set of frames and not really wild geometries in the bulk. Probably in this case, I guess it just follows from that. So it's like, for instance, also this radar construction, if you do it in higher dimensions, it might not work. to define a bulk point, because you might have caustics and so on there. But in this case, it works because I already know in advance what the geometry looks like. It's just a patch of ADS2, so I only have changes of frames in it.
Classically, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, but also quantum mechanically,
But quantum mechanically, what I know happens in many, you know, in most quantum gravity theory is that the frame E1 does not commute with the frame E2. So when you fix it, you're imposing second class constraints, and which means that you're killing quantum gravity states. So if you don't understand the commutation relations of your observables, and you fix them, then anyway. So sometimes it's a subtle point, like it's how many quantum gravity state there is behind one geometry, one classical geometry. So
I think the only point where I actually fixed something is by the choice of boundary conditions at the very beginning.
Okay, if that's all, then that's okay. Then you don't.
After that,
then you have then you should have many quantum gravity states that represent this, you know, represent the same classical geometry. That's where the entropy is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But maybe we're entering the question. You should maybe finish.
Let's
first.
Come back to these questions maybe at the end, if we ever reach the end of this talk.
I'll go quicker through the second. Yeah,
because no, I'm saying that there are many interruptions. So let's try maybe to be to.
Oh yeah, I'll try to go maybe a bit quicker. Okay, so there's a second physical point that I want to make. So as I mentioned, the IR region is where the strong quantum gravitational effects are coming from, which means that if I put one of the operators very close to the horizon and the other one somewhere in the middle, let's say, so not arbitrarily close, then this is actually a long distance effect. And it's very similar to a late time effect. And we expect strong quantum gravitational fluctuations. So we expect deviations from, for instance, the Rindler correlation functions, where Rindler space is the near horizon geometry. You can get further intuition for this by looking, for instance, at also a radar definition, so an operational definition of the geodesic distance between two points. So you can also compute this in this radar definition way, and taking the infinitesimal limit, of course, you reproduce the metric itself, and this thing is again just a Schwarzschild bilocal. So you indeed, plugging this in the pattern, you see that you indeed get strong deviations in the long distance limit or in the late time limit close to the black hole horizon. And this could have implications for the information paradox, because the conclusion that we seem to arrive at here is that defining these bulk operators in the diff invariant way in this particular theory can lead to the near horizon region being very different from the Rindler geometry. And this is like a breakdown of effective field theory. Now, I should re-emphasize these reservations. This is for this specific model, which is a quite strange model in general, although JT gravity is quite universal, as I also explained in the beginning. And then also it's for this specific class of bulk operators constructed in this specific way, and other operators, which might be not less natural to construct for this particular theory, they exist, of course, and they might not have this property. So these are some reservations for this, but I think it's an interesting point that the near horizon region is an IR region where you expect strong gravitational fluctuations if I construct this operator in a diff invariant way. Okay, so that was everything that I wanted to say about the bulk two-point function. Now what was supposed to be the second half of my talk, I want to talk about, I want to say a few words at least, about the spectral content of this bulk two-point function, because this probes the black hole thermal atmosphere or the Unruh heat bath. And I want to talk about very briefly then about two quantities. The first is to actually construct a detector measurement, and the second is to construct or to compute the bath spectral energy density. So first the detector measurement. So I'm going to define a detector trajectory in the bulk of a linear detector or an Unruh de Witt detector, also in this same operational way, in this radar definition way. So here I've drawn again the same picture where I've just taken two different clocks and I'm constructing a bulk point using this radar definition. But now I'm defining an entire time-like trajectory using this. So I use this radar definition to define entire trajectories. For instance, the blue one might be associated to the blue clock, and then another boundary time reparameterization, another off-shell F, let's say, would be the red clock, and this would construct a different trajectory in the bulk when I parameterize my bulk in Poincaré coordinates. So I'm just doing the same thing as I did before, but now for an entire world line. And then along this world line, I introduce the typical Unruh de Witt detection detector term, where I have an interaction Hamiltonian linearly coupling the quantum field phi to a detector degree of freedom that I call mu. So what one typically does in the quantum field theory in curved space-time literature is one computes the transition probability for the detector to go from its ground state to an excited state, which I will call omega. So the energy that is being detected is omega, without any information on the excitation of the quantum field theory matter state. So this would be the probability that I want to compute. I'm taking mod squared of this matrix element, and I'm summing over all final QFT states that I'm unaware of. And I'm writing this in first order in perturbation theory in this interaction Hamiltonian. Now, typically what you compute is actually the transition rate, not just the probability. So you take the limit where you measure over an infinite amount of time, basically, and you write down this formula. So this is basically just Fermi's golden rule applied to this particular system. So this is a well-known type of computation to do. What you do is you basically resolve the identity of these five fields here. Because the interaction is linear in the field, when you resolve this identity, you get a two-point function in the bulk of these fields. And so now this is fully determined in terms of computation of this matter two-point function. And again, this suggests that we just insert this thing in the Schwarzschild path integral. So we know the bulk two-point function for a generic frame. And then we just take that, we Fourier transform it, and then we get the transition rate for our detector. Now, for simplicity, I'll just talk a bit about the microcanonical ensemble. So instead of the canonical one, so there is just a Laplace transform between them. And this is only for technical reasons, because you have to do another integral. And the essential physics you can already see in the microcanonical case. So this is the answer. So it's just really a Fourier transform of that bulk two-point function answer that I gave you a couple of slides ago. So this is the answer for the response rate. I have extracted the detector matrix element already. That was in the previous slide, because that's just detector physics. It has nothing to do with the bulk physics that we want to probe. So now a few comments about what this formula is doing. So first you have this sine factor here. This is just an interference factor coming from the image charges across the ADS2 boundary. So this is a boundary effect, a boundary condition effect. The interesting piece is the second piece. So you have the singe thing. You have a product of four gamma functions and a Heaviside, and this thing is the matter emission probability. And notice that this has a Heaviside function. So M is the black hole mass. So we're in the microcanonical ensemble. We fix the energy. So this is would be the black hole mass. And omega is the energy that's being detected in our detector. So this means that omega has to be less than M. So this signals back reaction effects. No energy greater than the original black hole mass can actually be detected in this detector probe. Now, well, to give more confidence to this formula, let's look at it in the semi-classical regime. So for a large black hole, where M is very large, and for a small energy excitation, so we take the probe approximation of the system. And then you can just, well, readily compute what these gamma functions can be evaluated just using Stirling's formula. And you get that this thing just reduces to basically the Bose-Einstein or the Planckian black body spectrum. So this thing is generalizing it. It is including the path integral over this Schwarzschild degree of freedom of the quantum gravity in this case. And in the classical limit, you reproduce this Bose-Einstein emission spectrum, or this Planckian black body emission spectrum. Okay, so this was everything up to this point was for the genus zero topology from the Euclidean perspective. So for the disk. So this Schwarzschild degree of freedom is a typical thing you would compute for the disk, but during the past few years, well, actually the past year, I should say, we have realized that including higher topology in Euclidean gravity is actually important. Now, typically, these would be strongly suppressed by a factor like this, where G is the genus of a higher topology surface. And this would come, you would get such a factor from the Einstein-Hilbert term like this, which is just topological in two dimensions. So the Einstein-Hilbert term itself is just the Euler character. S0 would be the extremal entropy of a higher dimensional black hole from which you derive the near extremal near horizon regime. And you would add this term to the JT action that I mentioned in the beginning, and the only thing it would do is it would give a weight factor to higher topology. And if S is zero, the extremal entropy is very large, which is what we always assume here, this would be strongly suppressed. So the ordinary intuition would say you shouldn't consider higher topology in this case. It's very, very strongly suppressed. But we have learned in the last year that this can be important in certain regimes where the suppression is compensated by another enhancement, such as late time or small energy separation. And these are some famous recent examples, so I'll skip that, but the replica wormholes to find the page curve, and then also the late time average correlation functions, they have this ramp and plateau regime. You need higher topology effects in the bulk to reproduce this. So from the Euclidean bulk path integral, you need these higher topology effects. Now, the higher genus expansion in general is expected to be asymptotic, which means it requires a non-perturbative completion. And for JT gravity, it was proposed by Sachenker and Stanford last year that there is such a non-perturbative completion, which is just a double-scaled random matrix integral. So perturbatively in this random matrix integral, you would reproduce the genus expansion, but you complete it into a full theory. So this was what they proposed. And they studied this for multi-boundary amplitudes in their paper. And then we also, after that, we studied that for boundary correlation functions as well. And this was sort of further studied and systematized by Phil Saad in his paper last year. And what he showed is that, that these computations show that the contributions for these higher topology or higher genus effects, their main effect is actually to just correct the n density factor in the correlation function. So what I mean by this is that, for instance, the two-point function, the boundary two-point function, so if you remember roughly what the formula looked like, it had two row zeros in it, which were just singes square root e. So this is the two density factors, and you should just replace this by a random matrix pair density correlator, in this case for JT gravity. Now, this pair density correlator for this random matrix ensemble in turn is very well approximated by the Gaussian unitary ensemble random matrix structure of the pair density correlator. So this is the famous GUE pair density correlator structure. And the only thing you basically need to do is replace the row that's in here by the specific row for JT gravity, and that's it. Now, some important qualitative features for this kind of pair density correlator is that it exhibits level repulsion. If two of the energies here, so if E1 and E2 are approximately equal, you get a cancellation between this disconnected piece and this connected piece to get a quadratic, you start out quadratically in the energy separation. And a second point is that it has high frequency wiggles. If you would plot this thing, you would see high frequency wiggles proportional to e^-S0, where S0 was this extremal entropy. And this thing is the random matrix expansion parameter.
Could you come back to what you were saying, that, you know, naively you're suppressed by exponential minus, and then in fact...
Yes.
How does that resolve that? So in what sense that guy is a...
I haven't done this quantitatively. This was just qualitatively, but you can explicitly see something like that here. So in this pair density correlator, you see this denominator here, E1 minus E2 squared. So this thing, this full thing, as I'm going to say in the next slide, is coming from a higher topology effect. So it is suppressed by e^-S0 powers, but the denominator, if E1 and E2 can come very close together, the denominator can cancel that suppression. And that is the effect that we will see. So there's a cancellation between the denominator going to zero and an exponentially small factor in the numerator. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah. So can you go back and say what was wrong in the original argument?
Was nothing wrong with it. It was just too quick, maybe, because you just say, there's a suppression like that, but that suppression might get compensated by other factors that appear in the rest of the formulas.
So what is the other what is the other mechanism that you can identify what is the main physical mechanism behind that?
Well, if it depends on situation to situation, but late times can do something like that. And in this case, it's a small energy separation. So you see it explicitly. If you would naively say the second term is subdominant because there will be an e^-S0 suppression there. Well, it's true, except when the energies are close together at this same scale, when the energy separation becomes of the same order as a suppression factor. So I'm just saying that this naive, this argument is too quick. Of course, it's true that this causes a suppression, but maybe other things might cause an enhancement as well, and maybe those two can compete. So that. Okay, so this was just mainly like how these random matrix things work. So let me first give you, or let me also give you a short intuition on how this comes about from a higher topology genus expansion. So this what I've drawn here is the disk diagram, the JT disk, and I've drawn a single bilocal line here. So this is a single Schwarzschild bilocal operator, the thing we've been studying throughout this talk. And now I've added terms where I correct these things with higher topology. Now, these higher topology corrections, they come in two classes. You have higher topology corrections that stay on each side of this blue line, and you can have higher topology that bridges this line, that connects the two regions. So the first two diagrams, or the class of first two diagrams, so where I just have the disk and disconnected higher topology, they would give you a product of spectral densities. So rho E1, rho E2. And that would be the term you would get here from a random matrix perspective. So it starts out with rho 0, rho 0, which is the thing that's just a disk, but then it gets corrected. I have not written out explicitly what the full rho is here, but the contributions that are in it are just higher topology effects that you would have just for a disk, for a single disk. And then the last diagram is something very specific for this two-point correlator. It connects these two regions, and this would be the connected contribution. And from the random matrix perspective, this would reproduce something like the sine kernel. So you can roughly see from geometry, connectedness and disconnectedness across this line, you can match that to the way these random matrix formulas look like. Now, this was all for the bulk. This was all for the boundary correlator. So I've drawn the boundary correlator, but throughout this talk, I wanted to study bulk correlation functions. But I've written these using this radar construction, and in particular, this HKLL bulk reconstruction formula, the trick we actually used. We were able to rewrite these in terms of boundary correlators. So what the strategy we will employ here is we will just insert the higher genus effects directly in the boundary correlator and really assume that this bulk reconstruction formula keeps holding. So the bulk reconstruction formula is assumed to be valid also for these higher topology effects. So this is just a strategy on how to, or what it means to include these higher genus effects also for bulk computations. Now it's very simple, if you follow this, to see what the final answer is. So the detector response rate looks roughly like the one we had before. The only difference is that there was a singe here. Now that singe is replaced by the paired density correlator of this random matrix ensemble, rho m minus omega divided by rho m. And you can see if I turn off the random matrix or the higher genus effects, this would just become rho 0 m times rho 0 m minus omega in the numerator divided by rho 0 m in the denominator. The rho 0 m's cancel, and you would just have rho 0 m minus omega, which was this singe factor again. So this thing generalizes the previous types of formula. So now let's just see what it looks like. So I've written the formula here again, and I've plotted it here. I have not plotted this interference factor because it's always there and not extremely interesting, but the remainder looks roughly like this. So this small red curve, this solid line that's here, is just the disk result, the one where I turn off the random matrix or the higher genus effects. Now, if I do turn them on, what I get is these wiggles, these high frequency wiggles, and then the level repulsion you can see here as omega goes to zero. So these are the effects on this Unruh de Witt detector response rate that are caused by random matrix effects or by higher genus effects. So they happen at a very short or a very small range of omega, but they do it in a drastic way. They take the entire result to zero by this level repulsion. It's also interesting that you can interpret this kind of formula as the product of probabilities. This first factor here, you can basically view this as the probability of the underlying black hole system actually containing two levels spaced by omega. Because my underlying system is it's assumed to take this random matrix statistics. It's a chaotic system, which means that, I cannot have two levels of this underlying black hole system to be equal by this level repulsion argument. So there's a probability there of actually having these levels. And then there's an emission probability for the matter sectors. And these two probabilities are basically multiplied together. So there's an interpretation like that in this case. Now, I wanted to say a few words about the Unruh-Bath energy, but I think I'm going to skip that. So I did the detector response rate, but you can also study what the energy density in the bath is. So I'm just going to show you the pictures for this. I'm going to skip the explanation and the formulas. Right, so this is the answer. So this is now a canonical ensemble result. It's only for the disk result, so genus zero, no higher genus corrections. What I've drawn here is the spectral occupation of the Unruh heat bath, where the red dots are the Planckian-like body spectrum, and then the blue thing is the JT disk result. So you correct the thermal occupation number of the modes of the Unruh heat bath using these gravitational integrals. You can also generalize this to other fields. So here's a result, for instance, for a fermionic field. So it looks quite similar qualitatively. And there are also further generalizations to other fields possible. So charge fields, also the supersymmetric case, supersymmetric JT gravity is possible to do these types of computations. And you find, this is work in progress, but it's interesting to see how these other features of these fields interplay with this gravitational effect. And then finally, just one more plot. You can also try to go for the spectral density to go beyond the disk to include higher genus effects. And well, I just want to show you the left picture. You see these in blue, these high frequency wiggles, and again, this level repulsion. So the results are qualitatively very similar to the one I showed you for the detector response rates. Okay, so to conclude, JT gravity is a toy model of gravity, and it strikes, in my opinion, an ideal balance between relevance and solvability. So by relevance, I mean the arguments that I mentioned at the very beginning. It is the low energy sector of all SYK type models. It is one of the most basic and non-trivial holographic 2D gravity models. And it is universal in the near, extremely near horizon regimes of higher dimensional charged black holes. And it is solvable, as I showed you just for the two-point function during this talk, because the gravitational degrees of freedom reduce to just a boundary time reparametrization, and you have explicit analytic solutions for the correlation functions, non-perturbatively in the Newton's constant. We also have an explicit understanding on the role from the Euclidean path integral perspective again, of higher topology and then the resulting random matrix type of effects. And during this talk, I have computed bulk two-point functions and their frequency quantum. And I've showed you that these two-point functions exhibit bulk locality. And also I've showed you in the second part that there are gravitational corrections to the Unruh heat bath and the detector response, which include this level of repulsion, which is a signature of random matrix statistics at ultra low emission energies. So I think JT gravity is an ideal test case to study some conceptual questions you might have about quantum gravity. So thank you.
Hey, let's thanks Thomas. So, more questions?
Yeah.
Eli?
Sure. It's a beautiful work. It's a lot of work. It's very well done. It's difficult to criticize it on any point of detail. But let me just ask you why you feel justified in making the last statement. You say it's the ideal laboratory to study conceptual questions about quantum gravity.
I did say some conceptual questions at the end.
Well, with respect, and maybe there's something I'm not getting, but I've been thinking about the conceptual problems of quantum gravity for a long time. Tell me which of those questions we have insight into now. And so, by insight, I mean not the way some toy model might behave in lower dimensions, but what might really be happening in nature in 3+1 dimensions.
Yeah, so especially these random matrix effects, they show you signatures of the underlying discreteness you might have. You have these high frequency wiggles. It's still a continuous model, but it has signatures of discreteness. You can actually try to really include discreteness in the system by adding additional brains in the system. And we have studied this in another paper, so I haven't talked about that. But those are questions you might ask. Another thing is from the boundary perspective, at late times, for instance, the SYK model has this, you have this typical behavior of the late time correlation function, where it first has a slope, then a ramp, and then a plateau at very late times. So one of the questions you might have is, how does bulk gravity get to this? And these random matrix effects are doing that, or these higher topology effects are doing that. So a lot of the questions are actually motivated from the boundary theory, from holography. But I think it's interesting to see how you can explain this from a bulk perspective or from a gravitational path integral perspective.
Sure. So I like random matrix theory. I've played with it. I've worked a lot with it. Explain to me exactly how the random matrix theory is provided. I mean, random matrix theory has lots of interesting features.
Yes.
You quote some of them acting here. But why is that insightful for quantum gravity?
The fact that, what do you mean specific for this? So this specific model is just a random matrix integral. So that was shown last year by Satchanker and Stanford.
Sure.
But I think it's...
That's exactly what I'm asking you for. I'm asking you in the real world, and I'm not trying to be confrontational. I would like to be, here's something interesting I'd like to be able to get on board. Give me something that I can get excited about.
Well, we expect a black hole to be a quantum chaotic system generically. And this random matrix, of course, is realizing this in a very concrete way in this case, this random matrix computation. So it matches with our general intuition that a black hole behaves intrinsically like a chaotic system. And we had this formula, for instance, for the response rate of this detector, where we multiply this probability of the energy levels being there for the underlying black hole system. And well, because we had a random matrix system, they are, of course, quantum chaotic. So it's an explicit, in formulas, an explicit realization of this general idea and this model, of course.
Okay, that's fair. Let's go on. Maybe somebody else has a question.
You're on mute, Laurent.
So maybe just a remark, like with respect to my question, where are the quantum gravity fluctuations? It's clear to me that it seems that when you are doing this Euclidean path integral, you're still at the classical level. You're not really quantizing the theory, because at the quantum gravity level, let's say the geometry is discretized, and then of course even the notion of topology is not fixed, and you have fluctuations, as you know well, like, you know, you can have links that jump around. And so these are fundamentally quantum geometry. So maybe that's the insight you have, is that this sum over geometries or this matrix model is kind of a classicalization of the real problem of quantum gravity. So maybe that's how I interpret your results, is that if you were really doing quantum gravity, of course you don't have classical geometry, and a quantum state contains many objects that, you know, don't have a classical interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And then you might be able to, you know, reinterpret this mess, this quantum foam, in terms of maybe classical mm-hmm. geometries and some of a topology, which seems to be the theme that ADS-CFT is in. It's as if you want to understand quantum gravity purely from a classical perspective and never deviate from that. Yeah. And then maybe that's why it looks very unnatural in the beginning, but complicated. That is, maybe there's, so I don't know if that's how you resolve the thing, that maybe it's dual. And once you start to include fluctuations, then it looks like the quantum gravity states I would write. So, but of course, quantum gravity, gravity, the challenge is that we don't have a classical interpretation of most of the states, right?
When I use the word quantum gravity, I really mean the Euclidean path integral over metrics. That's on
yeah,
a,
I think this, really this what one, I'm doing. Yeah, the way I view that, I think it's very classical, like, because it relies on many classical concepts, the notion of topology, the notion of mm-hmm. continuity, which in fact are completely relaxed in a quantum.
Yes.
You were really quantizing gravity in the bulk and introducing
the fundamental
degrees of freedom. This one would not look like Euclidean objects. But
from the path integral, this seems to be the way you should do things, right? Because I basically have a field theory of the metric. And if you can do that path integral, which you can do in this particular two-dimensional case, then I would say this is a version of quantum gravity. But maybe definitely not the version that, for instance, in four dimensions that would solve.
Well, I think the version. Well, no, but it's you're right. It's a version that the problem is that it's a version that relies already on a lot of classicalization. For instance, you know what we know is that if you quantize gravity and you look at the boundary states of quantum gravity, they don't look like classical metrics. They look like, I don't know, you know, purely quantum objects. So already, you know, the way you parameterize your notion of manifold, your notion of topology, your notion of boundary states, all of that already, you're assuming that the boundary metric is a classical object. There's already a lot of classicalization going on, which in fact, in the theory of quantum gravity, you have to derive it. Right.
But is that not sort of like the magic of the path integral, that you are writing something with classical fields, so you can use the classical intuition for the integrant, basically?
The field, yes, but not the boundary conditions. That is your... I mean, I know specifically, let's say, in 2D BF model, that you can cut yourself from many quantum states by imposing boundary conditions which are not compatible with the quantization. So...
Okay.
I mean, I think here there's a strong assumption in ADS-CFT that the boundary metric is a classical object, which in fact it is not. So, and then it looks magnificent. Somehow people were able by summing over geometry to kind of maybe go around that. But
I think there's
something which is taken for granted in ADS-CFT, which is in fact, I mean, highly non-trivial, or in fact, just simply not true.
Yeah, I see.
It
would probably be quite valuable to understand parts of this story and the stories that other people are developing in this field, to understand these better from a canonical perspective as well.
Aldo can comment. In fact, he has, in 3D, we have a quantum gravity model, and in fact, you know, a boundary states in 3D gravity is a very complicated and quantum object. And if you want to map it to something that looks like a classical ADS geometry, you have to throw out a lot of information, in fact, which are fundamentally quantum. But yeah, it's interesting. There's clearly a lot of, somebody else can comment on the relationship.
Well, let me say something very naive. One of the first lessons of the path integral in ordinary quantum mechanics is that the support of the measure is not on continuous metric fields. Whatever the field is, whether it's a metric or a scalar field, the support is only on discontinuous trajectories and discontinuous fields. And that's somehow the meaning of being able to do the path integral, is being able to integrate over discontinuous trajectories. So it happens to be true by accident that you can dominate the path integral in some simple cases by critical points, which are smooth trajectories.
Yes.
But that hides the reality of the quantum fluctuation.
Yes.
Which are, anyway, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yes. But we have done more than, of course, just taking the saddle solution. We have done not just we, but other people as well have done the path integral explicitly in this case. And I didn't present it here, but we have many checks that seem to support the answers that we find. So also, I've presented basically one semi-classical limit where you reproduce this Bose-Einstein or this Planckian occupation number, but all of these correlation functions have many semi-classical checks. For instance, when you look at the out-of-time ordered four-point function and you take the semi-classical limit of the resulting expressions, you find these iconal shockwave interactions that people have been studying. So you find these only in the semi-classical limit of a more generic expression, a more generic in Newton's constant, I mean, in 2D Newton constant.
I guess we're giving you a hard time because we are a crowd that we try to focus on the thing which are not what we expect. We try to focus on the thing which are the most surprising effect of quantum gravity and the one which are not semi-classical. And that's the one we're familiar with. That's the one which we find interesting. And So, for instance, what I was saying about boundary condition is that if you take in Kanon's matter, it's well known that you have, let's say 2D BF model, and you have these topological insulators. Where do they come from? They come from boundary conditions, which involve duality, where you diagonalize both the electric field and the magnetic field. Mm-hmm. And this is not possible at the classical level. So classically, you will not find, like, you know, these. So what you realize is that when you quantize the theory and you understand really what are the constituents picture of your quantum theory, then there's new type of boundary conditions that come into play. And in fact, these are the ones that dominate the quantum behavior. So if you were probing your theory without imposing these boundary conditions, you would not see the quantumness of the theory. And then you would have to work very hard. And maybe this is what this matrix model R is, that, you know, by forcing yourself to always be Euclidean and classical, you're kind of missing the, you find what you expect, but I think the most interesting things about quantum gravity, at least for us, is the surprise, the unexpected. Mm-hmm. So it's nice that now maybe once you include the sum of a topology, maybe then you start to really have some quantum gravitational. I don't know for sure.
So, at the very beginning, also this choice of boundary conditions is the one that gives you the theory that low energy SYK models would have.
Yeah, but I have no idea why SYK has anything to do with quantum gravity. Honestly, I think quantum gravity is good standing.
I think that's a very interesting question, and I think many people are or were thinking about that. So it's still not known what the precise holographic description or the bulk description is of the SYK model. But at least it's your low energy description is known, and it is described by this type of model. Mm-hmm. But that's what sparked the interest, at least in this model, a couple of years ago. From this perspective, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are also people that have worked on the canonical. You mentioned Verlinde. Verlinde has pushed a lot for a much more quantum gravitational perspective.
Finding these explicit expressions, for instance, for the boundary correlators, I also worked on that, and that was in collaboration with Hermann Verlinde.
Yeah. So what about the, since about conceptual, what about the central, you know, the clue? So one of the main questions in quantum gravity is what are the quantum gravitational states? So the nature of this entropy. So what are the quantum gravitational degrees of freedom that account for a geometry which classically there's only one. So what kind of insight this approach gives us to that fundamental question?
Not at the level that I presented it here, but this theory is equivalent to an SL2R type of BF theory. And from, so we have done that in previous work. From that perspective, you can think about how this theory would factorize, and then you would introduce edge states along the boundary to have the theory factorized. And you can describe explicitly what they look like. But okay, so that's a group theoretic description. But you have states and you can count them and so on, and they would give you the singe measure that I described earlier. So the singe measure of the Schwarzschild at high energies, this would just give you the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of a classical black hole. So you can't get to that counting from a group theoretic way when you write gravity in its first order formulation in this way. I think you're muted because I cannot.
Sorry, do you understand from that perspective why the singe measure, which is an exponential improvement compared to the Planck-Schrell measure, right? So that
okay.
The Planck-Schrell measure, what you're counting is just the representation states.
Okay, that's
moving through, but now
yes,
you know, it's as if you were you have an exponential number of representations. So do you?
Yes. So that's a very interesting question. Also a very difficult one. So the singe measure is a version of a Planck-Schrell formula, just not the one for SL2R.
Yeah.
So SL2R has a tanh, Blancherel measure. But well, we had a different perspective on the precise realization of SL2R, and also Herman Verlinde and collaborators had another one. So they would claim that it shouldn't be SL2R, it should be a specific limit of the universal cover of SL2R. So the Blancherel measure for the universal cover isn't just a tangent, it's a more complicated formula, and in a suitable limit, this thing would go to a singe. We also had a paper on this, but we claimed that it's also not just SL2R, but SL plus 2R, where the plus means the sub-semi group of only positive SL2R matrices, where all four elements are positive, so not strictly a group. But that thing is studied also in like the quantum group literature, but mostly by Teschner and so on. And basically, you can take a classical limit of that quantum group structure, and you get something which is SL plus 2R, which also has a singe Blancherel measure. So I think it's a subtle point on how precisely you get from these. And so there are several possibilities or suggestions now that people have on this. So I guess we would agree that it's not just SL2R. It's mathematically slightly more than just SL2R.
Do I remember correct? Maybe I'm confusing works because I just looked very briefly into that. But do I remember correctly that was related to modular invariants?
Modular invariants of what?
Of the because that's.
But it's not.
No, I'm confusing 3D. Sorry, yeah, I'm probably confusing.
There is also an issue with modular invariants as well. So if you compute these higher topology things from a BF perspective.
Yeah,
I think you're not getting the correct counting of the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. Instead, you're getting the cover of the universal cover of that, which is Teich-Müller space. I think that's what the BF computations in higher topology in this case would do. So I think that's what you were referring to. But that's not the same. I think as what the as why it's a singe measure and not a tanch.
Yeah, it's not predictable.
Is there an understanding of if you take this, let's say this modification of SL2R as an exponential enhancement of
Yes.
So if you try to have a pictures of instead of having one SL2R representation that circulates, now you have an exponential number of them.
I have thought about.
Is there any relationship between that and the fact these which are quantum like these enhancements of quantum states, which needs to be understood and the sum of a topology.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I have thought about that, but I haven't come up with a satisfying answer. But yeah, that's a very interesting question. So somehow gravity wants this singe measure and this exponential increase of states. This exponential increase of states, by the way, at large energies, it goes like e to the square root e, which is the Cardy formula at large energies, and that's also no coincidence. So we understand where that comes from, but just from the Bekenstein-Hawking perspective. Why do we need a Blancherel measure that is growing so fast? Or how do we actually cleanly get this or motivate this from a group theory perspective? So we know from a group theory perspective at least how to get from one to the other, but why does gravity want this one? So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. So
since you work on both, you haven't made the connection between the talk you gave her and what you just discussed there? Because that's essentially some of the questions we were asking. What's the,
well, I guess it's all
what's the connection between the two?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I would like to know that, but okay, I haven't found a satisfying answer.
Okay, because or let's say maybe you have thought about that. What is the, because there in this SF2R and you have this exponential measure, you don't need matrix model. You know, you have lots of quantum gravitational states, so matrix model should be a stopgap measure to really do the proper quantum gravity.
Oh, okay, yeah. But when I said that I have thought about this, I didn't necessarily mean the connection between the random matrix perspective and then the singe measure. I just meant where does the singe measure come from, basically?
Yeah, which is already a big thing. Okay.
Yes. And why gravity wants, it has some, well, you can also track it down to the fact that basically from an SL2R perspective, there's like this, okay, I don't know how to say this in a clean way, maybe, but there's like a sum over all winding numbers in some way, while gravity would only pick the singly wound sector. So that, yeah.
Yeah, but say like that, that, that was like remark, but... thing, so that, that sounds good, and I think this is the sense of what you're doing, but say it like that, it sounds like you would restrict the number of configuration, not enhance.
Yeah, but gravity, okay, so you need to restrict. Yeah, so yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you need to restrict something to enhance. So
yes, you're restricting something, and you get more states out of it. So that that's definitely an interesting question. And I, you know,
how did that happen? Yeah,
I talked briefly to William Donnelly about that, but maybe he has some comments. If he's, I don't know if he's actually here.
He must have some comments.
Right. So we are almost 18 hours, so I think that we should maybe thank Thomas again, and so it's probably quite late over there, so
yes, 10:15, so
yeah, I think it's time to call it a day for you, and so thank you again for the seminar, and hopefully we can continue this conversation in person sooner.
That would be nice.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Thomas. Bye.
Bye.